Where'd you pull that out of? Where'd you get?
I don't know.
Is that a stamp, by the way?
It's like a sticker.
Mm.
I won't go in focus, but.
How much money for you to get a Luigi tattoo? Realistically.
A lot, man.
Yeah.
I have no tattoos. Imagine if my only tattoo was Luigi.
Like, all of your debt you erased. Like, you know what I mean? If you got one Luigi tattoo, did you do it?
I have no debt.
Okay,
what do you mean?
All right.
I'm Italian. Fuck.
Okay, that's fair.
What debt?
What do Italians want here? Good internet for the rest of your life. Now here, good movies. Oh, yeah, here, one IMAX theater next to you. In
oh,
what,
dude, yeah. I'll tattoo Luigi on my forehead.
You're now listening to Large Pod.
Everything sucks, and we're all gonna die one day. And welcome to episode 115 of Large Popcorn, a space where friends gather around to have elevated and comfortable discussions about all things film. I am one of your co-hosts, Christian Macias, and alongside me every single week, my Italian cinestallion, my David Lynch lover, and your letterbox fiend, Ugo Binai. Hello.
You're bringing too much energy to this.
Hey, Monkey Man.
And you need to chill.
Monkey Man.
Oh, it's Monkey Man? Okay. Okay. Yeah. I guess. Sure. What would be my...
the animal?
You know, underground fighting ring animal thing.
It would have to be animal related, sure. What is the national animal of Italy? Let's look that up. National.
I wouldn't know.
Animal of Italy.
The fucking cow, because we eat a lot of meat. I don't know.
The Italian wolf.
I don't know.
Legit, the Italian wolf, known as Canis
Is
Lupus
it?
Italicus.
Lupo.
Lupo.
Okay. I guess I could be a lupo.
Lupin.
That's funny. Yeah, that's where it comes from. You know? You ever heard of Latin?
What is that?
It's like an ancient language that the Romans used to
speak. Yeah, it sounds like a dead language.
It is kind of dead.
I'll tell you what, though. I did start the moniker for today's show in a really weird way. I'm thinking ahead to the Marquee Week episode, which is a mistake. I think the conversations for Real Week would be a lot different. So my apologies. Folks, this is Real Week at Large Popcorn, a general discussion episode dedicated entirely to events occurring in the film world. Stick with us next week for another film analysis Marquee episode. Quick reminders, you can always dial in at speakpipe.com/largepopcorn to leave us a VM for us to play on the show. Or, I mean, alternatively, you could be like Jackson Wells. If you have my phone number, you can just voice message me your actual thoughts on movies and I'll just relay the message on the show, which I will be doing later this episode. You can also follow us on Twitter at largepopcornpod to keep up with details on upcoming eps. And lately, I've been watching a lot of movies. So I've been sharing my own. What does Letterboxd do? Just show us your like four recent watches.
Oh,
your whatever.
Four,
yeah.
Four favorite. Yeah.
Not four favorites.
It's like
recent
Letterboxd 4 on Fridays, I guess, is when they do that.
Yeah. Lots to talk about today. For now, let's get into our first short segment of the day, starting with hey, look at that. Mini reviews. We've got reviews of recently released movies, two of which we'll be talking about today. First up, Dev Patel's Monkey Man directorial debut. We've both seen it. Hugo, You action guru that you are, what are your thoughts on good old Dev Patel's Monkey Man?
I really enjoyed it. As you could guess by the types of movies that I usually like, it's it's kind of an unusually structured action movie from, I think, from a Western perspective. It is kind of more similar to how some Hong Kong action movies are, where a lot of the action is like at the beginning and then in the third act of the movie. And then there's kind of a middle part where it's more plot stuff. So the structure, I think it can throw some people off, but I didn't find it that disorienting. I thought as a directorial debut, it was pretty impressive. Like, it's kind of crazy that he right away comes out with something that has such a sense of identity to it. Not only because of obviously the culture that it's immersed in, but it has like a distinct visual style and like stylistic choices that are being made. It doesn't feel generic at any point. The action is really great. I think there are some moments where the camera is just a tiny bit too close to the action, and I wish I could just see it more, because you can really tell that they choreographed all of this so well. But because of the stylistic choice of all of the movie is shot very intimately, very close to the characters. And I think in general that works in its favor. There are a few moments where I wish it was, the camera was kind of further away and I could see them fight in a wider angle. But generally, I really enjoyed it. I thought as I said, the immersion in Indian culture was really interesting. Doesn't hold your hand as somebody who's maybe not as familiar with Hindu folklore, Hindu religion characters such as Hanuman, which is features in the movie quite heavily. I mean, it explains some of the basic, but it doesn't really over-explain, which I think is cool. I've seen some controversy about its politics, as in some Indian commentators saying it's kind of a little unfocused exactly on what it's trying to say on current events in India. But obviously I don't have as much insight on that. But there's some articles by some critics. There's this guy called Siddhant Adlaka, who is actually a co-writer on the Patrick H. Williams YouTube channel that also writes criticism and like op-eds and stuff.
He co-wrote the Bollywood, not the Bollywood, I'm sorry, the episode RRR, right?
He did that. Yeah, and he participated in that, but he's now like a permanent, he co-writes.
Permanent writer on the
most
show.
Of those videos. So he's really a good writer. And he's from India. Like, he not even like Indian of heritage, he's actually born and raised in India and moved to the US to pursue work. So, and he wrote some pieces about how it was a little confused as to what the movie was trying to say necessarily. But you know, I think the general idea of the movie is, you know, a certain type of nationalism is bad. Sure. Whether you find that a little simplistic or not. Depends, I guess, on how much you know about current Indian politics, which is an extremely complicated political landscape because of, you know, cultural reasons in the country and how, you know, divided into small communities it is. But as a film, I thought it was really good. I really enjoyed it. What did you think?
You know, I'm glad you asked. Here you go, Penai. The first thing I want to mention is, I think, what is this, like a just under 2 hours, just slightly under 2 hours, like hour 40, hour 50, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Weirdly enough,
it's like, I think it's like two hours considering credits.
Gotcha. Sure.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, the people behind me at the start of the, right before the start of the third, like the final act, the climax sequence, left the theater. Which I found very strange, very odd to sit through an hour 30 of this movie and then just decide to dip out. It's very, very, very weird thing to do.
Maybe it's the best bit.
I agree. I will say, I think my biggest only criticism of the film, again, having not been just not well versed in Indian politics, is that. Not that the motivations of the film aren't clear. They definitely are. But I think it was the presentation of them. I can't quite pin it down. Like, something about this did not didn't find myself resonating with as strongly. Maybe it was, without spoiling, maybe just the way it was presented, I found just a bit detached from. Despite that, though, and I think this might be the theme of movies in 2024 for me. We'll circle back on that at some point next year. I think for me, the way I've been approaching movies this year is, like, despite critical faults with some of the movies I'm watching, they're never at the detriment of my overall enjoyment of the film as a whole. And I thought Monkey Man, despite, like, the way, like, again, the familial presentation of it, just found it a bit lacking, was still ultimately a really great movie. As a directorial debut, despite some of the messiness, I found it to be, like, pretty freaking awesome, with a lot of, honestly, pretty visually inspired shots, especially in the middle of action sequences. You talked about the intimacy of the camera, sure, but there's also a playfulness that I found really interesting, where, like, you'll have, like, little breaks in the action with camera placements looking at reflections of the characters, which I found really interesting, or, you know, a lot of shots to the paintings in a room that they're fighting in, which of course is, like, they want to just have, like, direct in your face, like, look at the symbolism here and think about the mythology there. And overall, I found it to be just a really strong directorial debut, despite some of its faults. Mm-hmm. Fun movie.
No, I really agree. And I think the story behind the movie is makes it even more, you know, makes it cool that it's actually so good. You know, the fact that it initially was supposed to be on Netflix and then, you know, it kind of went away and they weren't going to release it at all. And then Jordan Peele saw it and you know, pulled some levers at Universal to actually get it released in theaters. I thought all that stuff was really cool. And even at its inception is Dev Patel. I've seen some interviews of him saying how in love he's been with action movies his whole life, and just the fact that, you know, people with his, you know, not just cultural background, but ethnicity and even just physique, and, you know, he's kind of a very tall, skinny guy, don't really get cast in these types of action movies right now. I mean, Keanu is kind of an exception, I guess, but still, it's not really easy for him to access those types of roles. And he said something like, usually in an action movie like this, I'd be the hacker guy behind the desk or whatever. And the fact that he kind of, you know, took his destiny in his own hands and created the role that he wasn't getting cast in that he wanted is pretty awesome.
And then for it to be received as well as it has been.
Yeah.
Maybe not commercially, which is kind of a bummer. Sometimes that doesn't happen. Critical success can't translate to commercial success all the time, but still, it did make, I think, a sizable return.
It did okay.
Sure.
And I think it put him on the map, I guess. I mean, it currently sitting at 22 million worldwide. I don't know what the budget on this is, but it's probably not crazy. So, you know, and imagine if this just went to Netflix, just people, nobody would have been talking about it. So even you know, how many action movies get released on Netflix and you don't even know they exist?
Hey, I've never seen The Gray Man. I'll say that much.
No, I mean, I've never seen the fucking Extraction with Chris Hemsworth.
I did see that. That was a COVID movie, I think. So I was like,
people say that movie has some good moments, but, you know, does that have any cultural
does not
impact?
Stick.
And no. And I think Monkey Man, regardless of how much it does at the box office, it'll still have some people who are, I think it'll be like a cool cult classic action movie from the year 2024 in 10 years.
Absolutely.
So that's cool.
I do want to mention real quick, we talked about it before on previous eps about Dev Patel's inspirations for action cinema going beyond, of course, John Wick.
Yeah.
However, that's not to say that also that is, as far as the United States goes, that is like the cultural touchstone for a lot of, for current action cinema, right? And as I left the film, I heard it's like a group of like maybe like four or five people who went to go see this together. One person commented to the rest of the group being like, oh my God, that was more violent than John Wick.
Oh yeah.
There's some violent moments in this. cool stuff.
In fact, I think one of its best features is actually how violent it is. Like, I wrote bone crunching in my Letterboxd review, and I think that's how it feels. There are moments that you really feel the pain that both him and the people he's beating up are feeling, and I think that's cool. It is over the top in a sense, because it's also like a movie where the main character does like a video game. Each level of this building has different goons that I have to beat until I get to the final boss, which is very video gamey. Like, even the way that he comes out of elevators is like, oh, new level. Now you beat up these people. But it still feels kind of grounded a little more even than John Wick, where it's so balletic that in some ways it divorces itself from reality a little more than this does.
This is a 4-star movie for me. What about you?
Yeah, same. Yeah.
Tangential question before we move on. The writer of the John Wick series is working on a adaptation of the video game Sifu. Will you be watching Sifu in theaters?
The writer of the John Wick series?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, if it looks good.
Sure, yeah.
That seems culturally a bit weird, doesn't it?
I don't know. Whatever.
I mean, isn't Chad Stahelski also technically supposed to direct a Ghost of Tsushima movie or whatever?
Oh, Will that ever happen? I forgot about that, dude. I forgot.
Yeah.
I kind of hope not, to be honest.
Like, there's part of me that's like, oh, Chad Stahelski doing samurai action. That's great. But I don't know. Like, I feel like maybe you could do the action and you could get some cool Japanese director to actually tell the story in that setting. That would be better. He could be a stunts coordinator that he's done in other movies. I don't know. Seems weird, but we'll see when those projects actually come to light, if they do.
You know what else seems weird?
Hmm.
The ongoing political discourse of Alex Garland's Civil War. I do have to mention, of course, A24's biggest opening ever, racking in an opening weekend box office, I think, of 24 million or 25.
Yeah, I think even more. I think the initial estimate was actually lower than the final number. Yeah, it says 25.7 million.
Sizable, huge for A24.
Yeah.
Hugo, I'm really bummed.
I think A24's biggest movie is still Everything Everywhere All at Once worldwide, because that one had a different release strategy, so I'm not sure the opening weekend wouldn't match, obviously. But we'll see if this one can get there, probably. I think it could.
Hugo, I'm really bummed.
Why?
I mentioned this privately on Twitter, but I really thought, for whatever reason, I just had forgotten that Civil War comes out later in Italy. Not by much. You're going to see it, I think, later this week. But I really thought by the time we're recording, I desperately wanted to, obviously, your background in what did you study? Political history? No, just what kind of politics did you study?
Political science and international relations, but yes.
It would have been huge to at least have someone to bounce shit off of on this podcast. Now it's just going to be my dumb ass being like, all right, let's try to make sense of this. Obviously, without spoiling, let me give you my thoughts on Civil War.
Sure.
I had to bounce this off of my friend who studies American history in terms of literature for like his, does this, he's a PhD candidate. I think it's like his fifth year now or fourth year. So I had to bounce it off him just to see what he was thinking. And for me, initially, I think the Twitter discourse for this movie has been really boring. I think it is everything kind of wrong with the way we approach media right now. I know the use of the word dichotomy is overused, but everything is very hyperbolic these days, with like a critical fault of a movie being the make or break. Where if it does fail one certain aspect, the entire movie just does not work. And on the other hand, if that does click with them, or if they do make sense of it, then it is a masterpiece. Alex Garland doesn't miss. And I think there's a lot of room for nuance that this movie actually weirdly exists in.
Okay,
go ahead, please.
I think I need more context for this, because I really haven't I mean, this course hasn't reached me as much on this movie because maybe because I've been avoiding it because it's not releasing here until next week. So I'm not sure exactly what people are saying about it.
So let me set the scene here. Of course, the movie Civil War is about a new civil war in the United States. You know this. You know the backdrop.
Sure. Yeah. Of course.
Discourse online has been about the film's agnostic approach to its political backdrop. It does not have anything to say.
Which is okay. Yeah.
And I mean, some people say
we had been reading the interviews, I think, from Garland saying the exact same thing right before the movie released.
Yes and no. Yeah, he definitely kind of does have something to say, but it is surprisingly, like, his interviews have more to say about the political backdrop than the actual movie itself. Again, I'm trying to just be very vague about the movie.
Yeah.
And a lot of people online have been talking about the film's objectivity as the whole, like, telos of the movie. Like, that is the point. Here's a scene that, I'm not going to mention the scene, but here's a scene where, like, you know, the thesis of the film is kind of, you know, laid out through dialogue. Which, sure, I would push back on that. I'm not going to here in this setting because I want you to see it for yourself first before I start describing it. And I think for me, when I think about this movie's politics, I think about Garland's interview. I can't remember where, but he talked about the inspirations for the film in terms of how he approached writing, directing, producing the actual movie, which was Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now, of course, in some ways, a meditation, adaptation, whatever you want to call it, on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Heart of Darkness has a lot to say about colonialism in the Congo. Very, very explicitly at times. When I think about this analogy with Civil War, I'm like, okay, if these are our kind of touchstone inspirations, what is the analogy here? Is Civil War meditating then on some kind of criticism of partisan politics here in America? There is something there. I don't think it's entirely objective or impartial. Like, there is a little bit something to say there, but I don't think it's enough. I do agree that, like, the politics in this movie are messy and pretty much agnostic throughout, kind of at a fault. Like, you almost, when you have this kind of setting, it kind of begs some kind of exploration. You don't have to have like succinct answers to everything or have everything laid out, but you do actually, you should have something to think about or give the audience something more to think about rather than this like, both sides bad, which I think is a little bit too easy. Maybe I don't think it's enough textually for me to engage with. All this said,
because the thing about Apocalypse Now is that it is doing the same thing that Heart of Darkness does. It's very much, I mean, the fact that Heart of Darkness is a movie about colonialism and Apocalypse Now takes the idea of colonialism and brings it to the Vietnam War is in itself very powerful commentary. So it is. Even just in that, telling you something. And then the movie goes full psychedelic and becomes, you know, something interesting just on a kind of an artistic visual level. But it's very much has that base level political commentary baked in its concept. I'm not sure how that compares to this, for example.
Yeah, and I think a little bit has to do with, you know, Garland as an outsider pointing the camera, literally the camera. The movie's about photojournalism. At American politics, he is an outsider, but like he is situating himself within the American political landscape, and you just feel that sort of disconnect. I myself as an American, you feel that disconnect. Where it's like there's like almost like a moment, or there's maybe a little bit of a conversation where it's like he's pointing the camera at the two-party system in a way and kind of critiquing, like, who are the real victims of the two-party system? Really, it's all of us, which is fair. Everybody, it's a valid take, of course.
Yeah.
But I can't help but also think about the nuance of that, where it's like, okay, well, let's think about the two sides here. And you know, I think about the current landscape where some, you know, some fights or the difference between, like, having universal healthcare or like rights, and the other side wanting to abolish you know, freedoms mm-hmm. for certain people. It's like, okay, well, that kind of argument falls apart yeah. for me a little bit. Anyway, I'm kind of getting too into the weeds mm-hmm. here. All this to say that despite this critical fault of mine, I go back to the same thing I talked about with Monkey Man, where the overall movie, the actual filmmaking, surprisingly, just as compelling as any of other Garland's projects. It's a lot of it is actually even great. The art of tension in multiple scenes is fantastic. The character relationships and the acting of the characters here is like legit, really compelling. And it's largely entertaining from start to finish. Like I felt myself thoroughly engaged throughout. And that's such an interesting place for me to be, where like, huh, even if I'm finding a lot of these moments to be not where I want them to be, or not where I think they should, to still be walking away with like, that was still something interesting for me to walk away with. Especially with the photojournalism lens, I myself as a minor in journalism, like that is something interesting. And I talked to Jackson about this. He works in radio, and he sent me a VM about like impartiality and journalism and how he thought about this movie. And he kept thinking about good old Steven Spielberg with The Fabelmans and how Sammy uses it as a means to create art. And he's thinking about the scene where his parents are fighting and like I think it's where they're almost going to get divorced. And you have that shot of Sammy like looking at him through the camera and then and looking at himself in the mirror. I found that comparison really interesting, and I'm excited to see where you land on the other side of Civil War.
I'm feeling weird about this one because like in before the movie was released, I found some of the stuff that he was saying to be grating. Like it sounded. My comparison was like, remember when fucking Ubisoft developers will say something like, oh, this movie isn't really about, there's no political message in this movie, in this game about, you know, fucking US commandos, black ops in fucking Mexico where there's cartels and shit. There's no commentary, it's just a fun video game. And I felt some of that from Garland. And obviously I know he's not trying to communicate that necessarily, but there was a level that felt like that. And at the same time, I felt like some Americans were reacting to this idea of the movie. I mean, there was a lot of talk about this thing about California and Texas and whatever, and about, oh, those two would never go together. And from an outside perspective, I'm like, I mean, why they wouldn't? Like, they're the two biggest economies. If you look at the voting bodies and then you combine them, they're not that drastically different. Like, it's just that one leans more red and one leans more blue. But if you go to look at the smaller communities and how they compare to the big cities in both states, then it's ultimately not that much of a difference. I mean, there was, so I'm kind of in this middle ground with the movie that I'm really interested to see it for myself and see where I fall on it. Cause like, I also have the outsider perspective that, yes, both parties are pretty... Like, every time I talk about politics with somebody that's from America, I'm like, yes, I agree. The Republicans are actually evil and trying to take away rights. But also, the Democrats are a center-right-wing party in the majority of European countries. Like, that's... Those two things can be true at the same time. Like, I agree the moderates are better, but they're still, in comparison to the rest of the world, you cannot call them a progressive party. Because some of the, like, they can't even agree on universal healthcare, really. There's parts of the party that disagrees on that. So it's like, you know, it is difficult from an outside perspective to look at American politics and not feel, guys, what the fuck are you doing?
Right.
Why are these two options as they both suck? You know? But yeah, but at the same time, the idea of both sidesing it is weird anyway, because if we're going into conflict, one part is definitively worse than the other. Like,
sure.
So I'm curious where I'll fall on that. And ultimately, maybe setting the movie in America is a provocation enough that without commenting on it makes the conversation part of the experience in a way. Like, and if he was doing something more specific, maybe that would not achieve the same effect that he was trying to give. But I'm not sure. I haven't seen the movie, obviously. But it does feel like with his last few movies, he's trying to go into the more of a, what if I poke something that is sensitive and then don't fully pull through with it? But what does that cause?
Mm.
So yeah, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how I feel about it when I see it. But I'm still very interested. Like, I don't have a formed opinion on it, which is good.
Find out what Hugo thinks next week. Sorry, not next week. Next real week.
At Lark Popcorn.
But both of them ended up being 4 stars for me, which I found really surprising.
Mm.
Anyway,
we'll see.
Hugo, let's get into recent watches. I've got more stuff for you, but of course, I think I actually have been watching more movies than you, which is which is insane. But I mean, you've been busy with, you know, looking for jobs and whatnot. So please, what have you been into?
I've been looking for jobs and just not really watching movies, I guess. Like, the only movies that I watched are 3 fucking Dragon Ball movies. Because,
hell yeah.
I don't know. I've been rereading the Dragon Ball manga that I had, that I've had for 15 years and haven't read in 15 years. And then I started getting into Dragon Ball Super for some reason, and 2 of those are movies, so I logged them on Letterboxd, and they were okay. I don't know, it's dumb, it's fucking Dragon Ball. I don't really have anything insightful to say about it, but it's fun. It was a kind of... Do you know when sometimes you just want to...
Yes.
Watch something that made you happy when you were 12 and not
sure.
Think about anything else. Yeah, so that was kind of the state of mind that I was in. So, been watching Dragon Ball and reading comic books, and that's, well, manga, I guess, if you want to make that distinction, but it's dumb. So, yeah, that's kind of me this week.
Sometimes we need to heal our inner child.
Yes, yeah.
They never really go away. I still have middle school fat kid syndrome, and it's almost debilitating at times, but here we are.
It is what it is, man.
Yeah.
Although, I have to say, I need to step it up this month, because, like, I've only watched one movie that doesn't prominently feature martial arts in one way or the other. Which is kind of weird. I literally just watched 2 Kung Fu Panda movies, Sammo Hung movies. I watched Kung Fury, Monkey Man, and then Dragon Ball, and that's it.
Hey, you watched? I guess you watched our topic of the show next week.
Yes, that's the only one.
Okay, yeah. Well, April truly is the cruelest month, folks, isn't it? Thank you, T.S. Eliot.
Kung Fu month in the Hugo Pinay brain.
Yeah, you did that theme yourself.
Yeah.
So, weirdly enough, I had a bit of a Cameron, James Cameron bang at my house. Not back to back. There was another movie in between, but we'll get to that in a second. I watched The Abyss. I had missed the 4K restoration that there was going on domestic wide, where the theaters were playing The Abyss for the first time since release, which was a bummer. I really wanted to see it. So I was like, I had a day where I was like, I wasn't really feeling too well, and I was like, fuck it, let's watch The Abyss. I found it to be another sci-fi movie. I found it to be messy, but still largely awesome. Legit, there are so many really fucking cool sequences in this, and it's 1999. Mind-boggling to think about how some of these sequences were shot.
89, yeah.
Hey, you're right. That is 89. Yeah. Not 99. Thank you.
It's actually he did this movie, and the scenes that they were able to do with CGI convinced him that he could do Terminator 2 and do the ideas that he had in mind. Because before, he didn't want to do the Terminator 2 idea because the liquid metal wasn't achievable yet.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I like that.
Good movie.
Not as good. True Lies, the Schwarzenegger-led action comedy.
I haven't seen that one.
You should. It's, this is almost a 2.5 star. I'm not going to lie to you. Like, it really, the comedy just does not work for me in this setting. It starts off really convincing, something that I'm genuinely into, and then shifts into something else for a long time, almost for a really long time. It's like a 2-hour, 20-minute movie, and then shifts back to the original premise, which I find a little bit of a whiplash for me. But also, like, I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah, I should watch this at some point, just out of curiosity.
You should not watch I think the day before I watched Monkey Man, I watched the Jake Gyllenhaal-led remake of Roadhouse, produced and distributed by Amazon. So it's on streaming. It is not very good. I needed to know what it was like in the context of the film to see what how the action sequences were shot, like in full, without, you know, just seeing 2-minute clips of it on compressed Twitter. It does not look good. If you watch even the opening with Post Malone when he's fighting, it does not look right. Those action sequences, I see what the swing was like, but honestly, they shouldn't have even swung. Do you know how they shot it with the pillows?
Yeah. No, I don't actually know.
Instead of having two characters go through a choreography at the same time and shoot them, right? How action sequences are traditionally shot, they replaced one actor with a pillow, and they would have so one actor would punch the pillow, and they would film. They would film a second sequence where it was the other actor receiving a blow from a pillow or whatever it was. I forget how it was done exactly. So that they could then stitch these shots together and make it look like the force of the impact is actually hitting them.
I guess.
Sounds like it would work. I get it. Yeah. And then you look at it in motion, and it is the uncanny valley of like, this looks like computer generated graphics from like the 2000s. Well, they don't even look like real people almost. It makes it feel less impactful, which is a bummer when the whole movie is about a lot of like action fight sequences.
Doug Liman, man, what a weird career. Like, he's made a couple good movies, and then everything else is like some weird action movie that nobody likes. So
I love The Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow is great. Bourne Identity is great. And then he's made like Chaos Walking, that Daisy Ridley, Tom Holland movie where for some reason you can listen to people's thoughts, but there's one woman in the whole planet and you can't see her thoughts for some reason. And then there's the Jumper movie, which is like a movie where people can teleport and shit.
Hold on.
I actually saw that movie.
It's not good. I like Jumper for this, despite it not being good. I'm weird in that way.
Yeah, weird career, but whatever.
I watched Hamilton, the 3-hour musical from Lin-Manuel Miranda. The missus is a huge, massive, massive Hamilton fan, and she's been asking for a while to watch this, and I was like, through various scheduling conflicts. Let's do it. Like, I will give this a college try. It was very much not for me. If you're looking for a movie that like is even more agnostic to American politics to a very much fault, this is the one. This ignores so... I'm not going to get into this. Not for me. But you know what? Some of those tunes were legit catchy, and the actual production value of the Broadway performance is like genuinely really impressive. They really did pull it off. It's legit, like really cool.
This is the like filmed version of the show.
Yes.
Is it on Disney Plus or something?
Correct.
Okay.
There is an intermission as well, so we use that time to like, you know, take a little break.
Yeah.
Last thing I need to mention before we get into our news, Late Night with the Devil. Late Night with the Devil starring David Dasmalchian. I've never said that name last name out. Yeah. Yeah.
Dasmalchian. Polka Dot Man.
Polka Dot Man, directed by Cameron and Colin Cairns. This is another movie in the trifecta this month of like movies with a critical fault, but not being at the detriment of the entire movie. It uses AI. Yes.
Right.
It uses AI a couple of times with imagery that really shouldn't be here. I think I even agree with people being like, it's a slippery slope. We can't let the shit slide. Yes. No matter how big or small the production, I think generative AI in place of like paying a human to do this type of shit is wrong and should not exist in art forms. Get it out of here. Mm-hmm. I think there's also a bit of nuance here where like, despite this, I don't think we should totally review bomb the movie because a bulk of this is legitimately fucking awesome. I don't know if you, Hugo Panay, would personally kind of enjoy it. It is a horror film, but really it's more like a psychological thriller of this man. It's almost like this, like it's almost a gothic movie where the troubled, haunted past of this radio host turned late night TV talk show host struggling to retain ratings in a, you know, 70s satanic cult episode. It's really fucking cool. Genuinely gripping sequences in this. Campy, really fun use of the medium of like, we're going to use like the aspect ratios that fit, cutting in between like what a viewer would see on their television set and what we're seeing like in behind the scenes footage. They really do play with the medium here and it's fucking cool. And I think the ending is, without saying anything, is particularly awesome and is the kind of ending that I really enjoy in horror or horror type of projects.
Like, what does it use AI for? Because this just sounds like a movie.
It is just a movie, but they use like, okay, do you know when you're watching like Saturday Night Live or some kind of late night TV talk show host and they'll have like a picture on screen of like the backdrop of New York with like a title of some kind. Yeah. It's that. It's like when they're cutting to commercial in the show, they'll have a thing like a picture says, "We'll be right back."
Okay.
And that image was made using generative AI. Yeah. It's on screen for a couple of seconds and then it switches to like behind the scenes while the commercials are playing for people that are existing in universe. We're seeing what's happening on the set behind the scenes.
That's interesting, because like maybe they just came up with that idea so late into production that they just didn't have time, because I feel like that it wouldn't even be that expensive to pay a person to make, I don't know.
Yeah, well, they still should have.
No, I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm wondering whether the choice to do AI was like, oh, we came up with this idea to do little intermission images at the last second and we don't have time or whatever the fuck. Took a shortcut or something. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying I wonder how they came. Because, like, it's not like the AI adds anything to it. Or...
No.
And it doesn't feel like it's saving them, like, a massive amount of money if it's just some still images of stuff. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Weird. Weird choice. I feel like they should have anticipated the backlash.
Yeah. Well,
something that wasn't even like that big a part of the movie anyway.
Shudder continues to, I think, make, for me, the most interesting horror movies. I'm thinking of Mad God, which is, you know, they distributed. Yeah. That was fucking awesome. Last year's, I think Skinamarink was through Shudder. Granted, that movie is more divisive because the way they use medium in that is like largely boring at times, but I think it is a good movie overall. This is better. This is legit better. This was ended up being great and is, I mean, there's not that many movies out in 2024 that I've seen. I think I've like a top 5 or top 6. This is up there. This is this is above Monkey Man. This is above Civil War for me so far.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Cool movie.
Maybe I'll see this. It's not out here, but I'm sure it'll be on the streaming
soon, very soon. Yeah. Should we get into our movie news, Hugo?
Yes.
Definitely. Let's do it. Real roundup. First up, Cannes. I wish we were going.
Yeah, I really, that's the dream, you know? We should just start applying every
year.
Why
not? Yeah, why not?
Like, fuck it. Hey, I have a podcast. It's about movies. You know, it's only an hour and a half flight to Cannes from here, you know?
I'll just show up for fun. I'll pay my own ticket.
Oh, like you have to pay, but it the thing about Cannes, it's only invitation only. Like you can't get into the screenings publicly. Venice is different. In Venice, you can just pay and go to see the screenings. In Cannes, it's all invitation only.
I see.
So you can't just go, and it sucks. But the thing about it is, like, it's extremely expensive to stay in Cannes for a couple of days during that time. So even critics often from smaller outlets end up spending a bunch of money just to go see the movies as a preview.
Okay. I'll just go to TIFF instead then. Sorry.
Rough. Yeah. Just do TIFF. Yeah.
Yeah, let's do TIFF. Yeah.
Although Cannes is the dream for some reason. It just feels...
It's cool, cooler. Man. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fucking can.
I don't even know why. It's just cool. Huh. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Some news out of Cannes is we have the full lineup of movies in competition, out of competition, and special screenings and stuff. I only pointed out some of them because most of them we won't, you know, every year at Cannes there are movies that are breakouts that we don't know about. And, you know, movies like fucking Anatomy of a Fall last year, which won the Palme d'Or at Cannes and then became, you know, massive awards player and one of the best movies of the year. We wouldn't have known about it in advance because Justin Trier hadn't really directed big movies before that. So, you know, look out for the movies that we don't know about. But there are some that are from interesting filmmakers that I thought we could point out. The most obvious ones in competition are Megalopolis and Kinds of Kindness, which are both going in the actual competition of Cannes, which I didn't expect. The news out of Megalopolis is kind of weird, where there's been like some press, not press, there's been like some industry screenings, and some people are saying this is one of the coolest, weirdest movies I've ever seen, and then executives are like, there's no way this movie can you know, get any distribution. So mixed, I guess, thoughts on that. I don't know if what you're thinking about Megalopolis.
Very weird that, like, I saw that Jack Black was at the premiere, or not premiere, the screening that they did in LA, which is totally random. That came out of nowhere to have Jack Black talking about the movie. Like, this dude just shows up
it was just like an industry screening, so where there was a bunch of people there. Apparently it's extremely experimental, more so than people were expecting. And so it's going to be hard to distribute it, but we'll see how it is.
Who gives
up.
It? It's France. That sucks that this is the industry we have to live in. Where, like, you can't just say Francis Ford Coppola, director of, and just put in the Godfather Part One, Godfather Part Two, and be like, have the names marketed. You know what I mean?
No, I know.
I wish.
It's true. I agree. He also has not made a successful movie in 40 years. Like, there's part of it that I, in some ways, do understand, that it's like, oh, he's coming back to do this self-funded experimental movie with no control. It is a risk. Like, but I mean, somebody's going to pick it up. Like, somebody like Apple that did Killers of the Flower Moon last year will give it theatrical release and then put it on a streaming service. Like, you know, it'll be okay. You know, obviously getting good reviews out of Cannes will help it.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see how that shakes up.
Good place to have it screen, in my opinion. Yeah, if it is an experimental movie, like, Cannes is the place to do it.
Yeah. Famously, I think Apocalypse Now went to Cannes, and it is a pretty experimental film, and I think it won that year, and then obviously became a massive hit. Although, obviously, in a totally different time period.
Yeah.
You know, in 79, you could say, oh, the director of both Godfathers is making another a big war movie about fucking, you know, Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of gonna do well automatically. Obviously, a different time now. Boxy.
I'm more really curious. The more I hear, the more like I hear about its experimental nature, it's like, yeah,
it
of course.
Sounds crazy. Yeah. Yeah. I need to see it. Like, it's some people saying, like, it's playing with the medium, almost breaking the fourth wall type shit.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see somebody who's so pivotal to the history of American cinema trying something so experimental with his own money out of the vineyards that he owns in California. You know, sounds crazy. I'm into it. Another one is, again, Kinds of Kindness, coming out. I think it's coming out in June or something, like relatively soon after the festival. But it is screening in competition, even though it's a... I think it's an anthology film, although I think they haven't fully said that... I mean, I think there's going to be some overarching thing to it, I hope. And that's the reason why they're putting it at Cannes, because otherwise, obviously, anthologies wouldn't really get the kind of consideration that these other movies would. But the trailer looked awesome. I don't know if you saw it.
I saw both teasers, and I've seen the poster as well, which I think would confirm the anthology nature of it. There are like three different sections of that poster kind of coming together. This has the potential to be Lanthimos's biggest opening yet.
Oh, yeah. In terms of money, you mean? Maybe.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I hope this is cool. I'm very interested in it. We'll see what it is. Other movies from directors we can give some opinions on are David Cronenberg has a movie in competition called The Shrouds.
Yeah. You've been thinking about this movie for months.
I have been thinking about this movie. He's described it as like his most personal film. And it's like movie about, it's weird, it's like about corpses coming back to life, all sort of fun Cronenberg shit. So yeah, I'm into it. We'll see what it ends up being. But I'm very interested. Have you seen some Cronenberg movies? Are you into?
Have I seen some? Yes, of course I've seen some Cronenberg movies.
Yeah, what I mean is, like, what have you seen? What's your Cronenberg?
I'll tell you this much. I thought Videodrome would be my favorite. Solely based on the iconic poster that it has. I thought that one would just be... It ended up being, I think, the driest one for me. Mm. The one that I do like... I'm forgetting the name. Give me one second. Here you go. I don't want to give away what it is until I say it. Where is it? Scanners. I really enjoy Scanners. I need to see The Fly. That's one that I have never seen, but I've obviously seen the transformation sequences.
I'm not the biggest fan of The Fly. My favorite Cronenberg movies are like very clearly Crash and Eastern Promises are the two that really worked for me. Both. He has this weird tonal thing that I think is always fun to watch. Because it's like, there's clearly like an underlying sense of humor to how weird the tone is in his movies, even though the subject matter is quite serious. I'm curious to see what he does with this, because him describing it as his most personal film is interesting to me. It's about Karsh, played by Vincent Cassel, an innovative businessman and grieving widower building a device to connect with the dead inside a burial shroud. Whatever the fuck that means. So, yeah, I'm into it.
Recently, just this weekend, because I have all of Cronenberg's movies that I haven't seen added to my watch list, except for one that I forgot about. And I found out that you haven't seen it either. We should give ourselves some extra credit homework to do before The Shrouds comes out. And watch The Dead Zone with Christopher Walken.
Yeah, I never saw that one. I've seen a bunch, but there's still a few that I haven't gotten around to. Anyway, Other movies in competition is Paul Schrader's O Canada. I don't actually know what this is about. I think Jacob Elordi is in this one.
I'm there for a Paul Schrader movie. They're never perfect, but like,
yeah,
he takes some massive swings, that Schrader.
Yeah. So Richard Gere and Jacob Elordi and Uma Thurman are in this Paul Schrader movie. That's kind of insane. Yeah. Richard Gere plays a famous Canadian-American leftist documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, eat your heart out, Civil War.
Whatever. Yeah, yeah. We'll see. We'll see what that ends up being as well. Interesting there. And there's a Sean Baker movie in competition, Anora. You know, he still hasn't broken out of kind of the indie scene with his movies. Like, despite being very critically acclaimed, he hasn't really broken into the kind of awards echelon of films. But it's described simply as a comedy following sex workers. So, sounds great. I don't know.
Red Rocket, one of the most inspired movies of 2021.
I never got around to seeing it. I actually have not seen a Sean Baker movie. I'm sad to say.
Hey, let's do it.
Distribution has always been so bad that...
Yes.
Yeah. Because some of these indie movies, seeing them here is very difficult. And by the time they come around, it's like it's April and I've already moved on to the next year, kind of.
Yeah, so. Sure.
But I'll catch up. I'll catch up soon. I definitely have the Florida Project on the priority shortlist to watch soon. What else do we have? I mean, there's a film by Paolo Sorrentino. I don't know if you know who that is. He's an Italian filmmaker.
Sounds Italian.
Ugh. Yeah, it's disgusting. But he made the movie La Grande Bellezza, or The Great Beauty, which won the Best International Feature at the Oscars in, I think that movie's 2013. And this is his next movie in competition at Cannes. Could be cool. And there's a new movie in competition by Chinese director Jia Zhangke, which is he might be the most critically acclaimed mainland Chinese director, like not from Hong Kong, in this century, sort of. And I'd been meaning to get into his movies, and I think this is going to be the chance to do that.
Caught by the Tides, that one.
Yeah, Caught by the Tides is what that one is called. And then finally, there's some movies out of competition that are interesting. Obviously, Furiosa. We've talked about this on the podcast before. It's, and I think we're going to talk about it more with the next piece of news, but that's going to screen at Cannes. That's fun. I like that. There's always like a big wild action movie at Cannes. Like it's they don't just do art house, I guess.
Yeah. The Eternals.
Last year was Indiana Jones. It didn't work out perfectly, but yeah.
Was the Eternals not here?
No. Eternals. Eternals was in Italy, I think.
My fault.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah. Pretty cool. Furiosa at Cannes. So we're gonna get some, I mean, the festival is only couple weeks before the actual release, so it'll be fun to see how festival audiences react to it. I mean, Mad Max Fury Road kind of became the kind of the thinking man's action movie, like the movie that, you know, hardcore art house critics championed as, oh, finally, you know, we get a more elevated, I guess, action film in some ways. We'll see if Furiosa can kind of live up to that.
Put that on the 4K box, dude. The thinking man's action movie. That's awesome. Can we what? Yeah, go tell me. What's up?
Can we talk about this fucking Horizon and American Saga film? Did you see the trailer for this?
You asked me that last time. I still have not. I've heard it just looks bizarre.
You need to see this. It just looks like, what if we just did a John Ford movie? But 70 years later. And like, John Ford in the 60s was already making movies commenting on the tropes of the Western, on the classic Western. And this just looks like, oh, these savages from, you know, the reservation are attacking our ranch and shit. And yeah, it just looks wild. I don't know what he's doing with this.
Did he go bankrupt too? Like making this?
Yeah. I mean, apparently he made so much money with that Yellowstone TV show.
Oh, the show, yeah.
Which Middle America loves, apparently. yeah, we'll see what happens with this. I mean, this could be the movie that is like, you know, this year all the Republicans go see it and it makes $200 million at the American box office. And suddenly, you know, Costner is a genius for some reason.
The red wave is coming.
Yeah. We'll see, man. And then you add another one.
Yeah. Actually, heard of. So this is an out-of-competition movie written by Thomas Martin, directed by Lorcan Finnegan. It's an upcoming psychological thriller starring Nicolas Cage about a Washington surfer. I have no more details beyond that. All I know is you have Nicolas Cage doing something, you know, off kilter, and I'm there. And even better, a psychological thriller. He gets to really like play with acting when he can elevate, you know, utilize the medium in that fashion. Sure, I'm in.
Sounds silly. I'm into it. Yeah, so that's Cannes. Look out for reception from movies at Cannes, because lately one or two of the movies that end up being like Best Picture contenders and actually get a lot of attention at the end of the year come out of Cannes. So
I'm very much looking forward to the ones that we don't know about.
Exactly. Last year was the same. Like, I mean, I guess The Zone of Interest was kind of a little more anticipated because
Glazer
is, you know, has directed a bunch of movies before, but Anatomy of a Fall kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see. I'm excited to find out what the movies that we actually have to add to a watch list are out of that.
Yeah. I'm looking at you, Rebel Moon Part 2.
Yes, of course. Absolutely. Is that screening? It's not, right?
No, I just said it just to say it. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Jesus. Yeah, shall we move on to CinemaCon news?
Which I found fascinating for on both ends, for the slop that was on display and some of the cool shit. Do you get what I mean?
Yes, I get it.
I like your breakdown. Do you want to walk me through this?
I kind of went through basically discussing film, credit to them. I found really hard now with the way Google works now to find like
awful
good. Yeah, it's terrible. Like, you have to go to you have to know which sources to look for, go into their website, and then search. Because otherwise, it's really hard to get nice breakdown articles like this, for example. So, Discussing Film did a breakdown of each company and their major announcements that happened during CinemaCon. And I just pointed out some of the movies that might be worth discussing and some of the footage descriptions and stuff. And let's start with a dumb one.
Please. Absolutely.
Maybe the dumbest one of all. Disney, which tells you a lot about dumb, presented some footage out of Deadpool and Wolverine, where apparently it's him like sitting in a theater with fucking Hugh Jackman and talking about fuck you Fox, we're going to the Marvel universe, and then somebody from the TVA out of the Loki show shows up and they, you know, go to the TVA and they're gonna save the Disney universe or whatever that means. So yeah, that's the level of dumbass jokes we're getting in this movie.
I found that to be just absolutely dire, the state of these movies. And then to then just very dishearteningly read how like a lot of Twitter replies were like, well, cinema is back. And I'm like, really? Is this where the bar is with these movies? There's no way. But the movie's gonna fucking the movie's gonna make a lot of money. We can't deny it.
We'll see. I think there is a world where people are just done and this doesn't do that well, but we'll see. Apparently the line is, "Suck it, Fox. I'm going to Disneyland. Get fucked."
Hilarious.
Which is hilarious, yeah. I haven't never laughed this hard in my life. Disney also showed a bunch of stuff that they had Inside Out 2 there, that, but we've seen a couple of trailers for that. You know, we've seen a trailer for Alien Romulus, but I think from Alien Romulus they had a clip.
A scene. I didn't read the description of the clip, but I heard it. Go ahead.
Clip description starts here. We are introduced to Kaylee Spaney's Rain Carradine, which is apparently her character's name, and her fellow space crew, who appear to be exploring a mysterious wrecked spaceship. The majority of their crew is stuck in a flooded room with water up to their knees. What they don't realize is that they are in the middle of an incubation room of sorts, with dozens of alien pods holding facehuggers above them. Crew's android, Andy, needs to power down and reboot because of an error. While he's in the middle of rebooting, standing frozen still, the alien pods activate and release the facehuggers into the water. And the crew basically starts being attacked by the facehuggers, and that obviously that's probably the beginning of the film. The description goes on. It's quite a lengthy scene that they showed. I don't want to read too much more.
Right.
People seem to be into it.
Good.
I've been enjoying everything that I've seen from this movie, so we'll see where it ends up.
I was having this conversation with my friend on Podcast PXN, and we're talking about Kaylee Spaney specifically. Obviously, she's been in stuff before, and kind of some high-profile projects even last year. Priscilla, huge.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, breakout, cultural relevance, you know, what gig she's getting, this might be her year. To have two leading roles, I guess maybe the supporting role, if you want to think technically, with Civil War. But still, she's very prolific in that movie, and a standout even. But then to be leading Romulus, huge year for her. Exciting.
Yeah, she, you know, getting, also doing very different films that cast her as a principal role is also important, because sometimes young actors get kind of pigeonholed into one thing and never end up moving out of it. Next movie is also a big rising star, Paul Mescal, who is the protagonist of Gladiator 2, apparently. First they showed some clips of the first Gladiator, and then apparently it cuts to a scene where, like, there's a sword that is labeled Maximus, which is obviously the main character of the first Gladiator, and we see a hand grab it, which apparently is going to be Paul Mescal. Paul Mescal plays a character named Lucius, and who is a renounced nobleman who enters the arena, and Denzel Washington's character is his sponsor, in the same way that you know, Maximus had a person that was sponsoring him as a gladiator. Another movie that I'm wondering, is this going to be good? Like,
Joseph
Quinn is in it. Pedro Pascal is in it. Fucking Denzel Washington. I mean, the cast is great.
So was that movie The King or whatever it was with Matt Damon and... Wasn't that also a Ridley Scott movie?
Yeah, Ridley, all his movies look immaculate and the actual filmmaking is impeccable, but sometimes they're great, sometimes they're just really boring and nothing happens and the script isn't very good, but we'll see. I'm excited for it. I just don't know.
I'm excited. I come kind of leaning on, like, I don't know if this will be as good as I'm thinking it will be, but who knows? There probably might be some, like, really awesome set pieces in this.
There's going to be great set pieces. That's for sure. The one thing we can take away from that is that. But,
by the way, Paul Mescal, already, you know, big dude, muscular, fit.
Yeah.
Apparently he got even, like, which is way, way bigger for this.
Yeah. And he's the kind of big that I think works in this movie specifically, because he's not like he's, he looks like a man. You know what I mean? He's not ripped necessarily, yes, yeah, but he's big. And I think that works for this setting because, like, if he was shredded, it would almost feel a little out of place, I think, sure, in kind of a sword and sandal type movie. You want somebody who's, like, hairy chest, big, broad shoulders, but maybe even a bit of a belly because he's still fucking eating a bunch of food as at a banquet. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. From the Universal, obviously there's some big movies like the Wicked movie. Do you care about the Wicked movie?
Of course not. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No.
I don't give a fuck. But apparently people are saying it's going to be a big success. So we'll see what happens with that.
I don't doubt it. People see them.
Yeah.
There wasn't like Barry Jenkins was also here.
Yeah,
Mufasa?
That was the Disney. That was Disney. Right, sorry, yeah, yes, Barry Jenkins was there for Mufasa. Yeah. And he was like, oh, I've always dreamed of doing whatever. Please.
Move on.
Let's go back to Universal.
Let's go back to Universal.
Out of Universal, I think the one that I'm most... I mean, they showed some footage for Twisters, which I think is going to be fun. The trailers look fun, but I think the one that I'm most interested in out of Universal is Nosferatu.
Eggers.
Yeah, I think they showed like a clip or a trailer. I'm not sure if it was a clip or a trailer, but there was a description that sounded cool, so I'm going to read that out. But yeah, it's a trailer. So the trailer opens up with Lily Rose Depp and Ellen Hutter, who are two of the actors in the movie, saying, "Come to me, hear my call," right before a hand reaches out to grab her. She goes on to say, evil comes from beyond, and tells Willem Dafoe's Professor Albin Ebert von France, sporting a giant white beard, Willem Dafoe in a beard, is a win, that he is coming to us, while laying in a hospital bed plagued by some kind of sickness. We then cut to atmospheric shots of 19th century Germany, quick glimpses of a Gothic castle, a horrifying cemetery, the local city, and its many citizens carrying around coffins. Throughout all of this, we see Nicholas Holt's Thomas Hutter running away from some kind of danger. This just sounds great. The real money shot of the trailer is the image of Nosferatu's crooked hand going over the town as a gigantic shadow and covering it in darkness, only to then cut to Anna Harding with blood all over her face.
Great. It's gonna be awesome.
This sounds...
Yeah, absolutely. Like, mad.
Perfect.
Yeah. What do you think? Did you like the... Do you love the Lighthouse as much as I do?
It.
Hello?
I'm sorry, you cut out for me.
Do you love the Lighthouse? Do you love the Lighthouse as much as I do?
Yes, the Lighthouse. Incredible movie. Absolutely.
I can't wait for this.
I didn't love The Northman. I really enjoyed it, but I didn't love it.
Sure.
But this seems more the type of thing that I want from him, I think.
Yes, exactly. I do want to give a special shout out to Jeff Nichols's The Bike Riders, finally coming out. I'm equally as stoked for that one as well.
Next up we have Lionsgate, which had the Crow remake, which I don't really have a take on. Eli Roth's live action Borderlands, again, not whatever. I think it looks bad, but I don't.
I agree.
Whatever.
Yeah, not exciting.
The interesting news was about Ballerina. I mean, we already knew that it's the John Wick set film with Ana de Armas. They showed a trailer, and apparently she's like kicking people in the face while doing ballet moves, which signed me up for. Sounds great. Norman Reedus and obviously Keanu Reeves also in the movie. It's set between the movies, so not to spoil anything, but whatever. And the big news on this is that Chad Stahelski is basically directing half of this movie, and that's the reason why it was delayed. Like, he's going to make, like, five big action sequences for it. So whatever Len Wiseman directed wasn't considered.
good enough, right?
Good enough.
Yeah.
By Stahelski. So he just kind of took over a little bit on that one. So, yeah.
He grabbed the Infinity Gauntlet of John Wick.
This men guy, but
yeah.
Yeah, the Infinity.
I'll do it myself.
Exactly. It's just a golden gun with some gems on it.
Nice.
Yeah. There was footage for Furiosa, which I kind of don't want to read into at the... Sorry, this is a WB, because I really kind of want to save myself, I guess, for that movie at this point, because I'm just very excited for it. Don't need to see much more. The other two movies that WB had that I thought are worth discussing... I mean, Beetlejuice. People apparently are saying this is going to be a big hit. Again, don't really have a strong take on this. And there was the trailer for Joker 2, which was also shared.
Hey, hold on.
For everybody else.
Folie à deux, please.
Folie à deux.
Yeah.
Did you see the trailer?
We're in the hands of professionals, baby. Pull focus back to Joaquin. Perfect smile.
Oh, yeah. Oh, also, there's four colored umbrellas. So this is high art because...
They said this is for queer cinema. This is an homage to queer cinema. No, motherfucker, it's just an homage to a musical. What are you on about?
No, because you don't get it, Christian. Because like in Todd Phillips' head, musicals are gay.
Yeah, and so is the Joker. He's bi and stuff.
That's what he said.
Verbatim the quote.
Yeah.
You care about this movie? You care about Folie à deux?
No, like I think it looks. It just looks like more edgelord bullshit,
dude.
But now there's music in it.
I don't get it. This is like it's too much. Like having a Gaga with the finger guns and Joaquin's in the rain laughing. This is the wrong kind of insane for me.
Yeah, it's like. Very self-serious. I don't know, man. Like, we'll see what this movie... I'm not anticipating that I'm going to enjoy this very much, but I think it's going to be... I mean, the only thing is, there is a world where, like, it makes all the nerds really angry because there's, like, two musical numbers in it, and the nerds are like, oh, musical numbers are gay or whatever, and they get mad, which that would be fun. But other than that, I don't have very positive things to expect from this. Don't know about you.
No.
Yeah. I mean, and then we have the biggest movie that was shown there, at least as it concerns this podcast, which was Bong Joon-ho's Mickey 17. Bong Joon-ho and Robert Pattinson attended. There's a very cute photo of them on the red carpet thing they had going on where it said, like, practicing their prom poses or whatever. Sounds funny as fuck. I just want to imagine Robert Pattinson and Bong Joon-ho just hanging out, like, smoking cigarettes and watching movies in Seoul or whatever.
I can't wait for this movie.
Yeah. That just makes me happy.
Perpetually one of my most anticipated.
Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen with it. Apparently it looks very Bong Joon-ho weird, which I'm into. I understand maybe that's not as commercially viable as it should be, but, you know, the release date is weird because it is possible that since it's coming out in January, it will get like a festival release. Sometime in
in the fall, perhaps like October or something,
could possibly be in Venice.
All right, fuck you then.
which I might be able to go to again if this movie is there. You know, just saying stuff. Nothing's. You know,
your job will say no. You can't take time off.
Well, but
you have to stay here. And work for us. No, I'm just kidding.
It might be on a weekend. We'll
see. I'm being a dick because I would love to see Mickey 17 in Venice. Yeah.
God, it would be cool. Anyway, so there was a description of the movie, if we want to read it.
but on a personal note, I would say no. I want as little
you don't want to
know
it?
About the movie as possible. Okay. You know what? Fuck it. Let's do it. Let's.
Okay. So
who cares?
Robert Pattinson. The director describes his sci-fi film as a simple man's story.
Nice.
Which I love function. He just says shit. Yeah,
perfect days in space.
Robert Pattinson plays a common man named Mickey with a nerdy American accent who signs up to be an expendable in the future. He travels to distant planets and space stations doing handiwork. But the caveat is that he's expected to die during these difficult missions. Because they're so dangerous that he's just being used as fodder, I guess. Each time he dies, a new clone is made and given a new assignment. The title of the movie draws from this, as he dies 17 times, as the premise of the movie. Everything goes well with Mickey getting eaten and chopped up into different pieces across space. Things take a turn when two clones get made at the same time instead of one, Mickey 17 and Mickey 18. And that's the premise.
How awesome are these sequences from Bond going to be? Or, do you know what I mean?
Dude. Can you imagine the level of craft of that montage in Parasite where they, you know, figure out how to get rid of the housekeeper?
Applied to
Robert Pattinson getting brutally murdered and killed and squashed. For 17 times.
Well, one of the masters at being able to doubly portray like tension and intensity while also being highly digestible and even comedic and entertaining. Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait.
I'm very excited for this.
And there's two things you missed out on, Hugo.
Okay. You can
WB
then.
WB showing off a Shyamalan bang bang. M. Night coming in with Trap.
Oh, it's true.
And his daughter, Ishana Shyamalan, directorial debut of The Watchers, which does have a trailer, and I have not, or sorry, a teaser, I have not seen.
Me neither. This is weird, isn't it? Like, same summer they're coming out, apparently.
Crazy.
Yeah.
The Shyamalan movies are so interesting because, like, They're never like truly like perfect or, you know, like sometimes not even great for me, but like they're so entertaining. Do you know what I mean? Like a product of the yester cinema generation still around.
And he somehow figured out that he can make his movies for like $30 million and they're going to make $100 million, and he's always making his money back and he's investing into his own work and going to distributors just for the distribution. I think that's awesome. Like, and apparently he's bringing his daughter into the family business. Like, he's a very, in some ways, it's a very working man director who's just figured out a way to get his movies made. And I think just for that, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we skipped over Paramount's biggest announcement. Interstellar, in 70mm IMAX, and I will be going. I will be going to see it in 70mm IMAX.
Well, I won't because it's probably US only. So who gives a shit?
America wins again.
America first. Am I right?
Hashtag not my cinema, not my theater, not my distribution.
Anyway, like, it's a weird year for movies in the sense that it doesn't feel like there are as many known quantities as last year, for example. But I think there's a lot to look forward to, and a lot of movies that could go either way, where it's like, this could be massive bomb and nobody cares, but it could also be awesome. I think that's fun.
Like, where am I going to fall on Lee Isaac Chung's Twisters? You know, I have no fucking clue, but I'm there for it.
Absolutely. I'm actually going to, I've never seen Twister. Maybe I'll need to see Twister soon.
Also on my watch list. I have no doubt it's not very good, but why not? I watched True Lies, might as well watch Twister. Anyway.
Absolutely.
Folks, that's it for Real Roundup. If we missed anything, feel free to shout at us over on Twitter, X, It all happens on X. Sorry. And if any other big news breaks, stick around. We may just talk about our next ep. And that is it for Real Week at Large Popcorn. Stick with us next week for our marquee episode on Lars von Trier's Melancholia. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Remember to give us a sub to stay up to date with all our cinema thoughts here on LP. Until next time. Thank you, Ryan Johnson. Long live Chloe Zhao and Denis. We trust. Clear microphones. The mother is a jerk. Excuse me, junkie, which brought the work of the older to a new life. What a way. But this what a way has been a way of today. Anyway, push couldn't shove me to understand a path to a base set. Consumer should have raced it in a first wave. Cause second wave from believers and believers will walk to it, then even talk to it and say, you can go buy it if you want to buy soul. Nah, can't have none of that. Tell him what to say, mate.